This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com. Welcome to Dishy Mix. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. And you have been enjoying a two-part series with Steve Wozniak, better known as Woz. He's the inventor of the Apple computer, the founder of Apple computer, and the author of a new book with Gina Smith called I Woz, How I Invented the Personal Computer, Co-Founded Apple, and Had Fun Doing It. Our computer geek turned cult icon has spent a solid hour telling us about his amazing life. We're going to learn all kinds of things, from philanthropy to dating to gadgets to Segway polo to the US festivals, his favorite rock concert, and more.
I don't know that the role of schools, per se, is to teach us to be prepared for the technical future. I think that's something they leave you to get on your own. I think it's that the computer being such an important tool in our academic life, some of it has to be done in school, and some of it is done in school. It's strange. A very weak computer, you know, in the right mind, can do just as much as the most powerful, brand-new, modern computer there is. I ran into some people who were doing a lot of conceptualizations of what kind of projects would teach children this and that about the world, about society, you know, and how to work and what were good, healthy projects. And it was really an investment in the people more than the institution itself. But this particular show, the music was, there was something coming to my ears at an outdoor amphitheater that has never hit it before. The most, to be so beautiful, to sound like a record with headphones, and even better, how did they get that quality? I have no idea. I found out later they had speakers behind us, so the sound was coming from more directions than just the front of the stage.
So Steve, welcome back. Thank you so much for taking time to be on the show two times. I really appreciate it. Here's my first question. What would you take with you if you were marooned on an island, the one piece of technology you'd most like to have with you? And it can't be a satellite phone.
Yeah, a deck of cards.
Deck of cards? That's not technology.
Yeah, sure. Well, anything that has been created to give us, you know, entertainment or more in our life, I call technology. In other words, if you figure out a way to assemble a table with one less step, that new method is a technology. So cards are almost a technology. I mean, I could say my computer so I could play cards, but mm-hmm. I'd need power.
Yeah.
I sort of don't visualize power on this island.
No power.
And I think cards would keep me entertained the most. I think a lot of people would say, give me a pencil and paper. I can just write my ideas forever.
Yeah, yeah. I think I would do that too. That's a great one. So you have been a real philanthropist, and one of the areas that you've made some significant investments in is, both with your time and your money, is that you've kind of adopted the Las Gatas School District. You've put a lot of money and hands-on teaching and donations for state-of-the-art tech equipment. So how do educational institutions now need to prepare our children for the technical future? What do you see in schools today that's missing, and what do we need to do?
Boy, that's such a difficult one, because I don't know that the role of schools, per se, is to teach us to be prepared for the technical future. I think that's something they leave you to get on your own. I mean, when I was in school, we actually had driver training right in our schools,
yeah,
with the simulators and all, but now even those sort of things are just relegated to the side, and academics is more learning about things that are historic, like mathematics is historic, history's historic, music, whatever. Just learning the things that can be written down that are sort of known. And something like technology, how do you adapt to things changing? They don't have to. See, that's not a normal class in school. You know, how do you explore a device and get the most use out of it? I think that requires, if you had long classes, I taught classes to fifth through ninth graders for 8 years, and what I taught was how to make your homework look good, but it was 200 hours a year to teach all of the techniques to use a computer very well, and the kids learned it very well. And most people think, oh, computer literacy is just show them a computer in front of them, and 20 minutes later they know what to do. Keyboarding, learning to type at an earlier age, I think has helped a lot.
Do you think that schools need to teach technology and keyboarding and computer usage skills, or do you think it's better left at home? What's your personal opinion?
I think that the computer being such an important tool in our academic life, some of it has to be done in school, and some of it is done in school. You know, how to basically, you know, expertise on just searching for information to learn and to write reports about it. So I think a little bit occurs in school, but you know, the vast majority of us, we're all such different people. The computer takes us to so many places in the world. You know, better left to home. You know, sure, in home it's more just an entertainment tool, but you know, every kid has to get homework done, and the computer is the main way to do it. So I don't know that it has to be taught that much in school. Now, the ability to create new ideas, new programs, computers that do different things than they did before, robots someday. Oh, I wish that were in school.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's like, are we going to teach computer science to our kids? Only maybe one in 100 persons needs to really be well-educated in computer science to make our society go forward. So that it often gets left out. It's a very fun topic. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a type of logic. A certain mathematical mind will do better at it. But it falls in the category schools don't put a high priority on.
You know, one of the things that I worry about is the technology divide, the so-called racial ravine. If we don't teach it in school, are we going to leave behind children who are disenfranchised from a financial perspective?
Well, if you're talking about teaching people to design computers and understand how
I'm talking
they're
about
built inside,
using
we don't
them.
Need that for everyone.
No, but I'm talking about teaching children how to use computers. If usage and
yeah, the usage. Not only that, just the availability of computers, although it's strange, a very weak computer, you know, in the right mind can do just as much as the most powerful, brand new, modern computer there is.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some equalizing that we don't even see, that even older computers, 10-year-old computers, you know, can be hooked up and used right and really get a person a long ways today with what we normally do, communications and information searches and schoolwork and even to some extent, entertainment.
So I want to move on to some of your philanthropy. I know by reading your bio that you founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation. You were the founding sponsor of the Tech Museum. You're part of the Silicon Valley Ballet, maybe even a founder of that, and the Children's Discovery Museum of San Jose. You've put a lot of money into a lot of local endeavors. I'd like to know what's been the most rewarding philanthropic project with which you've been involved.
I would say probably the Children's Discovery Museum of San Jose, although ones like the Tech and the Ballet are very important to me. That's the city I was born in, and I always feel like I want to give back to the places I was born. I would go back to my schools and, you know, pay for a baseball diamond to be built here or, you know, contribute computers or whatever. I always feel good about, you know, my community that I came from.
Yeah.
And San Jose is very, very dear to my heart and always will be.
And I love how right in front of the Tech Museum is Waz Way, the street that's named after you.
Yes, we had a mayor, Tom McHenry, and he had all these plans for downtown and really helped get a lot of these museums we just talked about and the ballet, helped get it accomplished. And as San Jose was changing its look, and in that time they were building this street that would go in front of a park that was going to hold the Tech originally and the Children's Discovery Museum. And he came up with the suggestion of naming it Waz Way. And I was just so enamored. I'm not a developer. Normally, developers get to name the streets.
Yeah. You know, I remember the first time I turned onto Waz Way and realized it was there and it was named after you. And I was so pleased by that. I wasn't even aware that you were a progenitor of the Children's Discovery Museum or the Tech Museum or any of those things. I mean, I probably could have assumed that you would have put some money into those things. I never even made that connection. I was a consumer who knew about you as the cult icon driving onto the street named after you. And I can't tell you how pleased I was that you got that level of recognition.
Something like a tech museum, there are people who have ideas about children and what their needs are. And I cared a lot about children, but I wasn't one of the really super idea people. You know, I mean, I was certainly more ahead of others because it was my big interest in life. But really, I had a lot of money, you know, a lot more than you ever need. And I thought, I ran into some people who were doing a lot of conceptualizations of what kind of projects would teach children this and that about the world, about society, you know, and how to work and what were good, healthy projects. And it was really an investment in the people more than the institution itself.
Steve, we're going to take a short break to thank our sponsors. And when we come back, I have a question about being a little bit country and a little bit rock and roll. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. We're with Steve Wozniak, and we'll be right back.
Listen to Living Green, Effortless Ecology for Everyday People, a weekly online audio program featuring champions of sustainable living at personallifemedia.com.
We're back. Thank you so much again, our sponsors, for helping us have a great Dishy Mix with Steve Wozniak. You know, that is a beautiful segue to the U.S. festivals that you did. You put, for 2 years, you did a big concert out in, I think it was San Bernardino, right?
Yep.
And I was able to pull up the 82 and 83 schedule of performers, and I'm just going to read some of these off for listeners. You had everybody from the Ramones to Oingo Boingo, the B-52s, the Talking Heads, the Police, Eddie Money, Santana, the Cars, the Kinks, Pat Benatar, Tom Petty, the Grateful Dead, Jimmy Buffett, Jackson Brown, Fleetwood Mac. That was 1982. 1983 was amazing. It was a beautiful lineup. Everybody from Wall of Voodoo to the Flock of Seagulls to Men at Work. It was very 80s. Ozzy Osbourne and Judas Priest and... Oh, gosh.
It was a great experience. And I was trying to create one of these great things that young people will be influenced by.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the sort of thing that you look back in your life, you have a few experiences that touched you and changed your life so much. And there's a gentleman who was at the 1982 US Festival. I think he was at both. And he was in the Navy at the time. And it just affected him so much, seeing especially our technology exhibits, our education program. And now he's become very wealthy, and he wants to contribute and put back and put on another US Festival.
The US Festivals and the way you have the tech component and things like that really remind me of Burning Man. Have you ever been to a Burning Man?
I have not been to the Burning Man. It does remind me a lot of Burning Man also,
mm-hmm.
and the sort of people that would go. I'm just, I'm past the age and a little bit more middle-type person, so I don't go to a lot of the Burning Man. A lot of the, being around the weird people, it's neat to be around them, but I certainly wouldn't be one of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so if you had to do another US Festival today, what kind of music would you program into it? What do you love now?
I would actually not choose individual tastes, and the first US Festivals were not done based upon my musical taste.
Right, you
it's
like
sort
country.
Of which groups are touring. You know, there's a lot of, you know, you get some people that know how to put on concerts that are going to attract a lot of people. But we would go for still mainstream type music that's not really raucous and not really pushing people and nasty towards society. We'd go for good stuff, you know, Paul McCartney type stuff, U2 type stuff, and, you know, get some of the top bands to, you know, try to present a good image of people working together. You know, we can really take our society forward. We had themes like that for our original US Festivals.
So I know that when we were prepping for our interview today, I asked you what your favorite concert that you ever saw was. You said it was Roger Waters doing the Wall Tour at Shoreline Amphitheater, probably about 2003. Is it that you're a Pink Floyd fan or Roger Waters? Or what was it that touched you about that? You've probably been to so many concerts, including producing your own.
I'm not a Pink Floyd fan, per se, real heavy. I like some of their music from the past, and it's meant stuff to me. No, I go to an awful lot of concerts, and, you know, ones that have some special touch that grabs me, some incredible lights, or they dress it up like musicals, you know, they put on skits that go along with their songs and wear costumes and all that, really affect me the most.
Mm-hmm.
But this particular show, the music was, there was something coming to my ears at an outdoor amphitheater that has never hit it before. The most, to be so beautiful, to sound like a record with headphones, and even better, how did they get that quality? I have no idea. I found out later they had speakers behind us so that the sound was coming from more directions than just the front of the stage. And how they got this unbelievable, you know, feeling that music can give you, that it was just so unusual. It was just too real.
So it was a magical acoustic moment for you more than anything
else. That's a better way to say it.
And didn't you also fund the Shoreline Amphitheater?
Yes. Bill Graham and I were equal partners in the original, you know, money to fund that project. But I felt, the reason I jumped in, they were having trouble getting all their funding, and I jumped in because I knew that, you know, most of the tickets, well, more people were now in the South Bay.
Yeah.
And so many people in the South Bay, where I grew up, were driving all the way up to San Francisco to see a big concert. And that this would, I just knew it would be successful.
What I read about you is that originally you liked country music more than you liked rock and roll, but you told me that you love to collect hard rock memorabilia, t-shirts and blankets and backpacks and shot glasses and all that stuff. How did you end up loving to do a hard rock? Where'd that come from?
Hard Rock Cafe.
Yeah.
Not Hard Rock. Hard Rock Cafe.
Right, Hard Rock Cafe. Sorry, yeah, thank you.
I grew up with rock and roll. No, I grew up with rock and roll. Around the time we started Apple, I got influenced by a rare radio station that played not the standard, you know, studio promoted hits, but they played good music. It was called KFAT in Gilroy. And it really changed my whole music style towards the country folk singer-songwriter style more than anything else. And that's what I was in, even when I did the US festivals. That was my own personal type of music.
Right.
And now I like it all. I like everything.
And what do you do with all this hard rock stuff? Do you have like a big room full of shot glasses and hurricane glasses? Or what are you doing with it?
I did, but over time and some house moves, it sort of got put more into boxes and boxes in closets in the hallway, you know, full of hard rock t-shirts and stuff. I have medallions in cupboards out in the garage, little the hard rock medals that they sell, the pins. So, again, I still do it every once in a while. And, you know, there weren't that many hard rocks. I got to a point in my life where one year I went to every hard rock in the world.
Wow.
And after that, I never wanted to travel again. I think I went 15 years without using my passport. I was so tired from travel.
It's exhausting.
But now there are so many hard rocks, you can never do all of them in the world. There's just too many. But every once in a while, I'm in a new city for the first time, and I look up to see if there's a hard rock in that city. And I'll just go there. You know, I don't even like the food, but I'll just have something, buy a t-shirt, and bring it home. I actually wear them. I wear my Hard Rock t-shirts.
Well, it's funny. I was thinking about Hard Rock just this week. I blogged about them before I even knew you liked Hard Rock, actually last week, because Hard Rock just did one of the most innovative advertising programs in the podcasting world that's been done thus far. So they're still innovating, which I like to see as a brand, you know, continuing to move that brand forward.
And I'll have to tell you, going around the world and eating at all of them, and I don't only eat a couple of things, you know, usually chili and nachos, but I'll tell you, the best food, Hard Rock food in the world is in Paris. They're known for food. It's the best.
Yum. Well, that's good to know. I think that's the last place I'd go if I was in Paris.
Boy, I'll tell you, they've got these thick cheeses and
Well, you know, speaking of podcasting, here's another thing that I read. Tell me if this is true. I read that after hearing a podcast of an interview on the Larry King show, you began dating comedian Kathy Griffin. Is that true?
I didn't hear a podcast. I heard the show live on XM Radio.
Oh, on XM Radio.
I'm not sure Kathy understands that it is broadcast live on radio, even though it's a TV show.
Yeah.
And I was driving my car, and I did hear her on there. And I liked her jokes. I laughed at them, and then I saw her at a local show, but I thought I was getting tickets to a folk singer like Patty Griffin or something.
Oh, I like Patty Griffin, yeah.
And eventually I just read an article that said we were dating. Her publicity department had gotten to work on it or something, and it was just totally a shock to me at first. But we met and we like each other, and we get together, and we're going to be getting together more.
Well, now, one of the things that I know about you, a little secret that I know about you, is that in addition to being very generous, you like to give women very flashy rings. I did see in Us magazine that Kathy had on a very flashy ring attributed to you. Was that yours?
No.
Didn't give her a flashy ring?
I didn't even notice it on her. No, no, it was actually Greenwich jewelry, I think.
That's so funny, isn't it?
No, I don't like to give big flashy jewelry. No.
Would I like to get big flashy jewelry, just to set the record straight here. Even though you don't like to give it, I really like to get it.
I actually like fun, different, unique joke jewelry. You know, I'm wearing a ring right now. It's Mokume Gane. It's a real special process for making rings.
What is Mokume? It sounds Hawaiian.
It's actually it dates back to Japan, samurai sword days, and it's a type of you push metal through other metals to get patterns to appear, and it's it's sort of, I think it means eye of wood. Mokume means eye of wood, and Gane means metal. So it's a metal thing, but it kind of can, in the end, looks like it has a wooden pattern, but it's really different metals interacting with each other.
That sounds really beautiful. I'm going to have to Google
it's
that.
It's a tricky technology. That's what I like about it.
Right.
Or rubber rings that flash, that cost a dollar, and you squeeze them and they start flashing all these colors. I love jokes like that.
Now, see, I don't think you should discount Burning Man. Everybody wears that kind of stuff at Burning Man. I think you might have to fly in and check it out and fly back out again, because I really think it would appeal to you.
I know Burning Man people, because they're all the sort of people that think the way I do a lot.
But, yeah, that's what I think.
Well, I don't have to go there to have my fun.
Now, I know that you were in a terrible plane accident. Do you still fly small planes, or you don't even bother anymore?
No, I flew them after the accident, because to me, I did not have an accident.
Yeah.
I had the type of my head got hit hard enough that I lost all the memories of it.
I know, terrible.
Even for the next 5 weeks. So I have no feelings of pain, being in hospitals, anything associated with an accident that's bad.
So it was easy for me.
I got in another plane. There was no anxiety. And I stopped flying because I decided that my life was getting busy enough that I was going to be able to fly people out to lunch now and then, but I didn't have the time to put a huge amount of hours into flying to up my rating to, you know, single engine, instrument ratings, that sort of thing, double, twin engine. And if you don't really have time to be improving your skills, it's sort of just phony to stop at the first easy level.
Now you fly around on Segway polo machines, I guess. I don't know what you call it, a Segway that you ride and play polo, and you're part of the Silicon Valley aftershocks. I love that
name. I like unique things because you can't really be compared to others, and it avoids a lot of, you know, conflict. It avoids a lot of, you know, trying to beat the other guy, the competition. And so Segways are neat, and a lot of us geeks got Segways when it first came out. They were just so different.
Yeah.
To me, it's now become such a part of my life that it often replaces my big, huge car. I pop on a Segway, I go down my hill, in 15 minutes I'm in town, I drive into a theater, watch a movie, bring the Segway back home, and I got to skip the big world, the big car things. I'm a real simple type person, almost a minimalist,
mm-hmm.
and I get to skip now, you know, accelerator pedals and seat belts and seats and mirrors and adjusting this and going to get your car washed and then finding parking and then still walking across the street to the theater. I get to skip that whole big hassle.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. I've never ridden a Segway, but I'd really like to. Now, how could someone come out and watch Segway polo? Do you play often?
Yes, we have our group has a website, segpolo.com,
mm-hmm.
and we have announcements of when we play. We generally play the first and third Sundays of the month at a park in Sunnyvale, usually Ponderosa Park.
That
and we play
like
at
fun.
10 in the morning on the Sunday. And
okay.
We rent the park. Sometimes we play at 11. Right now we're starting most of our games at 11 a.m.
Yeah.
And people come out and we'll train them on Segways. When we spot new people, we instantly start teaching them how to ride a Segway, let them scoot around a while, and then we put them right into a game. And you can't do anything the first day you've ridden the Segway.
Yeah, you have to get good.
But they come back, they play another time, and they come back, and some of them become pretty good players. It only takes a couple of times, and they're right in with us.
Well, I'm going to bring Taylor down to Ponderosa Park, and we're going to watch you ride around on your Segway. I've got to meet you now. Sounds like fun.
Newcomers yesterday playing Segway polo with us, and they did well. You know, I mean, the ball would come, they have trouble knowing how to get their Segway around to get a shot at it, so
yeah.
We'll back off the beginners.
Yeah.
And let them make sure they get their shot.
That's sweet. Really fun. I can't wait to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been very generous with your time. I'm going to let you go. I have one last question for you. You've received a lot of amazing awards. You were awarded the Kilby Award, which is an award for embracing the spirit of creativity for the benefit of humanity. I love that. You were also inducted into the Inventors Hall of Fame. You were awarded the Heinz Award for Technology. You also got the National Medal of Technology by the President of the United States in 1985, and that was Ronald Reagan. That's the highest honor bestowed on America's leading innovators. I bet that's not even all of the awards that you've gotten.
No, actually, there's hundreds and
hundreds.
There's so many that I just put them around the house, and I never have one place for them, and
mm-hmm.
I can't even find them sometimes. The important thing is not having the award. It's having done something good,
yeah.
Whatever the award's based on.
And is there a particular honor of distinction that you most value? Is there one that really touched your heart? And if so, why?
I doubt there's only one. I have a couple of honorary degrees from universities. I have a distinguished engineering alumni medal from Berkeley that means a lot to me. the National Medal of Technology does mean a lot to me, very lot, because Steve Jobs and I got it the first year they gave it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the National Inventors Hall of Fame. That's one you can only get into if you're a real inventor that worked with the soldering iron in a laboratory. You can't be a businessman and
mm-hmm.
get into that one.
Mm-hmm.
And if I went down the list, there's probably a few special ones that I'm forgetting right now that really mean a lot to me. The Heinz one was really more for my teaching, hands-on, than for my technology, because they cared about a certain thing in you that really wanted to help people hand-to-hand. You know, it was very important. Teresa Heinz runs that one. And the Kilby Award, I'm glad you mentioned, because a lot of people don't know, Jack Kilby invented the integrated circuit, along with Gordon Moore and Bob Noyce, sort of like there were two different teams. And he was just the ultimate engineer, just a pure engineer working at things from an engineering term, and that's what I wanted to be my whole life. That was an important one, but so many, and some of them are so outstanding, so good. Some are like lifetime achievement awards. I get into halls of fame for consumer electronics and other groups, and they all mean a lot to me now. Originally, you know, oh, great, another award. I don't know if I want it. I don't need an award. But now, you know, every time I get one, I just feel so honored. It's like a special day. I smile and am just honored to hold it on a stage or whatever. They mean a lot.
They do mean a lot. Steve, you're an extraordinary man, and you've given so much of yourself your whole life. And I just want to thank you so much for being who you are and for the generosity that you've brought in addition to that big, beautiful brain of yours that's letting us all have personal computers and hopefully, like me, Apple computers on my desktop. Thanks so much for your time today. It was good to get to know you better. You're a darling, darling man, and I just really appreciate it.
Well, thank you also, and I hope to be, you know, a good example to other people that they follow and do those sort of good things.
You're an amazing example, and so thank you. I will see you out at Ponderosa Park the next time you play, and I wish you very happy holidays.
Okay, wonderful. Same to you.
Thanks, Steve.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is your host, Susan Bratton, and you've had an amazing opportunity to hear from Steve Wozniak. I hope I did you good by asking really important questions that you'd like to know about Steve that you couldn't find elsewhere. And I hope you have a great day and you're inspired by this truly extraordinary man. Thanks so much.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.